Good morning, everyone. It's August 10th. This is the first lecture. My name is Ken Turley, and the title of the talk is Sojourning in Egypt. As we all know, the lifelong journey that we call spiritual regeneration is mapped out for us over the course of the biblical narrative, beginning with the creation story and ending with the final images of the book of Revelation. To be a little more specific, focus in a little bit, the journey begins with a relatively simple promise offered by God to Abram. That promise, in essence, is, "Go where I tell you to go, follow my commandments, and I will bring you into a heavenly state." No big surprise, Abraham agrees. He enters into the covenant with God, and the journey begins. God takes Abram to the Holy Land right off the bat, first thing. And then, after giving him just enough time to set up an altar and get a look around, sends him to Egypt. To provide a little motivation, there's a fierce famine throughout the land. Little aside here, it's kind of interesting to note that as near as I can tell, throughout the Bible narrative, nobody wants to go to Egypt. Nobody says, "Let's go down to Egypt and spend our vacation." People go to Egypt for two reasons. Either there's a famine in the land, and if they don't go, they starve to death. Or two, somebody's trying to kill them. Well, there was the exception, Joseph. He went to Egypt when his brothers sold him into slavery rather than kill him outright, but I think that's the exception that proves the rule. Nobody goes to Egypt because they want to. Anyway, as I said, and as we heard in our scripture reading this morning, Abram is shown the Holy Land. He's taken to Canaan. The Canaanites are there. God speaks to him. Abram builds an altar. And then the famine hits. Abram is forced to go to Egypt. And here he sojourns. It says that right there in the Bible. A sojourn, for those along with me who didn't know what that meant in the beginning, it means a temporary visit. He goes to stay for a while. Now, I know that was a little long for a scripture reading this morning, but I read it on purpose because that little visit, Abram showing up in Egypt, the whole thing with his wife passing her off as his sister so he doesn't get killed, getting all kinds of respect and honor, loaded down with gifts because somebody or other figures, well, if we butter him up, maybe he'll let us marry this good-looking woman. Well, and then the truth comes out and him basically being pushed out of Egypt by the Pharaoh saying, "Good riddance." This little story has in miniature all of the dynamics of all of the visits by other people to Egypt that are to follow. A, they go because they have to, not because they want to. The relationship with the Egyptians is tense. And there is the issue of power looms over everything. And no matter how good it might have been to go there in the first place, the situation deteriorates. And the departure, no matter how welcome the leaving may be, is not without complications. It's not simple and easy, a joyous, heartfelt departure. There is tension in the air, mixed feelings, and God has something to do with it. Now, Abram is only the first to sojourn in Egypt. After Abram, as we heard, Joseph ends up there. Then Jacob and his entire family end up in Egypt, again because of a famine. Moses is born there, but he leaves under dubious circumstances. And then reluctantly returns to lead the Israelites out of Egypt, which, you know, the whole thing with the plagues and everything. And this is really the end of a rather long temporary stay that begins being the honored guest of Joseph, ending up in slavery. Actually, it doesn't really begin with Joseph. Correspondentially, this sojourn in Egypt begins with that first visit of Abram, at least correspondentially. There are other references to Egypt found in the prophets and the Psalms, and then in the New Testament, as we know, Jesus and his parents flee to Egypt to escape death at the hands of King Herod. Also, in the book of Revelation, it's not Sodom and Gomorrah that is referred to, it's Sodom and Egypt. Now, there's a couple of dynamics we need to keep in mind as we read about these various Israelites who sojourned to Egypt. First, we need to remember that the Bible is written in three levels of meaning. The literal level, which is the mythical historical narrative. There's the inner sense, which is on at one level the spiritual sense, which portrays the human spiritual regeneration process in relationship with God. And then there's the celestial level, which portrays the Lord's process of glorification. All three levels of meaning are present simultaneously, even when they are not all clear to our finite understanding. Yet each level of meaning can help shed light on the others. It's also important to remember that the correspondential meaning of any given item or place, depending on the context, can be its good sense or its bad sense. And we'll get into this a little bit later. We also need to remember that while at the literal level, the journey seems to be linear and continuous in time and space, the inner spiritual journey that is being portrayed does not unfold in a straight line. It is a process of moving through various spiritual states of being, moving into and out of and returning to these states of being countless times. I refer you to this diagram here. This is a very gross generalization of the whole of the Holy Land and the correspondential realms. We can think of this as Jerusalem, the holy center, the temple and all. And again, this is over all time. This is not one time specific. The lower southern part, the realm of Judah, the affections, the northern part, sometimes called Israel, being the reason. Over here along the shore, we have the place where the Philistines lived, which refer to faith alone, the hypocrisy that goes along with feeling self-righteous about what we know without applying it in good and charity in the life. And over here, the realm of Babylon and other of the nations that were both distractions and oppressors, the source of being carried out into exile. Now, the process, the external realm can be all kinds of things. Not being heaven, it is therefore hell. But the process of getting to heaven is not a straight line, but as we've heard referred to, it's a spiral, which puts us through these various states of being. And as we grow and progress, it's not going in any one direction, but passing through these various states of mind and heart over and over again, gradually getting closer to heaven. Which means that as we go through these various states repeatedly, we go through them at different levels of awareness, and affection, and the issues that we deal, while generally in the same, we encounter them at a different level. The temptations often become more and more intense, the evils more and more subtle, but in the end, it is our goal and the hopeful outcome that we end up in heaven. These external states, which are distraction and the farther from heaven, more and more hellish, are always with us. We never escape them fully, but as we get closer and closer to that state of heaven, they get pushed farther and farther to the outside and become less and less of a dominating force and more just a subtle influence that we continue to deal with. All right. Oh yeah, I did forget to mention the realm of learning and information, Egypt, which is now what we're going to focus our attention on. We're probably familiar with the idea of Egypt representing the realm of learning and knowledge, the realm of facts and information about things. And that's exactly right. Swedenborg says that the ancient church was actually in Egypt. And when the church was there, knowledges flourished more than anything else. It always kind of bothers me when Swedenborg says, and that is the reason why, but whether it's the reason why or the result of, Egypt represents this realm of knowledge. Relative to the Lord, Egypt corresponds to knowledge of knowledges, a grandiose phrase, but relative to all other people, just knowledges in general. I'll leave you to ponder the mysteries of that phrase. In Isaiah, it says, "My people went down into Egypt to sojourn there. The instruction of the natural man by means of scientifics and by means of the knowledges of truth." Egypt corresponds to scientifics and also knowledge, but such as are from the sense of the letter of the word. And to sojourn means to be instructed. George, Bill, Lee, any translators, have you come up with a better word for scientifics? The only thing I can think of that it's referring to facts, bits of information that just are. And this is at the natural level. So facts is a good word. So, okay, good. The Lord being brought into Egypt when an infant had no other signification than what is here signified by Abraham, and the migration of Jacob and his sons into Egypt in the inmost sense represented the first instruction of the Lord in knowledges from the Word. In the Psalms, the Lord is called a vine out of Egypt, in respect to the knowledges in which he was instructed. And then recalling that parable he spoke about, I am the vine and you are the branches. That what he learned in Egypt, what he learned in his study of the word, is something that continues through him and into us. And we're the beneficiaries of that. Whenever you hear the word Pharaoh, it means the same thing as Egypt, just the central point of it. At some point, you might cross the name of Hagar, the Egyptian handmaid. That's the affections of knowledge. And as I mentioned before, Israel's sojourn in Egypt was not reckoned from the entrance of Jacob into Egypt, but from the sojourning of Abram in Egypt. So here we get this sense that Egypt is information. It's the realm of information and the learning of information, but basically at the natural level. It's information, facts about things. It's not deep spiritual learning. It certainly has nothing to do with wisdom, meaning the use or the application. It's just plain information. Now, in the good sense, Abram's sojourning in Egypt represents the Lord's first instruction from the Word. Again, I remind you, sojourning is a temporary stay, and it corresponds to being instructed. Egypt corresponds to useful knowledges, the knowledge of knowledges which are able to serve as vessels for celestial and spiritual things. Now, this is a very important concept, the idea that the scientifics that are learned in Egypt are able to serve as vessels for the celestial and spiritual things. That knowledge or human wisdom is signified by Egypt is evident in Daniel, where the knowledges of celestial and spiritual things are called the desirable things in Egypt. Moses, at one point in Exodus chapter 2, is called an Egyptian man, and the reason is that Moses here represents truth such as there are with those who are in the truth of simple good. I think that's a pretty good description of Moses, at least at the beginning. A simple man, he's not very complicated in his thinking or his ambitions. Seems that given his unpleasant experience in Egypt, he's quite happy being a simple shepherd out in the wilderness, spending most of his time by himself. But true to divine providence, he was not to be left to that. Joseph, when he was carried into Egypt, corresponds to those who are in some truth of simple good. And Jehovah blessed the house of the Egyptians for Joseph's sake. And this represents that the divine at that time had the celestial natural, for the house of the Egyptians corresponds to the good of the natural mind. Gilead corresponds to exterior good, which is called pleasure. Egypt, in a good sense, the facts which are external truths of the natural person that correspond or are in accordance with this good. And finally, one other thought. Correspondences, representatives, and significatives, and as these were of service to the doctrinal things of the church, especially for the understanding of those things which were said in their word. Hence it is that the Lord, who is represented by Joseph, that when the Lord glorified his internal man, he first imbued the facts of the church, and from and by means of them advanced to things more and more interior, and at last even to divine things. Hence, in the words of Hosea, when Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. So from this we get the sense that in its good sense, Egypt has a very useful function. All this information is the vessel which the celestial and spiritual truths are contained. And that also, even for the Lord in his process of glorification, learning this information was the primary step to moving on into the deeper, more spiritual and what we might think more holy things. Now then, in either a good or bad sense, a wife for Ishmael from the land of Egypt corresponds to the affection of knowledges which is possessed by the person of the spiritual church. And the king of Egypt signifies facts in general, but again, the natural person, for the whole scientific is the truth of the natural person. In other words, facts, for the natural person, facts are their basis of truth. Nothing spiritual or esoteric. For the natural person, it's just about information. But after they began to abuse their interior facts of the church and turn them into magic, then by Egypt and by the magicians and wise ones of Egypt also began to be signified the scientific which perverts, or the facts which mislead. So, Egyptians, in a good sense, correspond to the information of the church, but in the opposite sense, inverted the contrary things of the church. Bondage in Egypt corresponds to temptation. The stay of Israel in Egypt was about half of 400 years. From the entrance of Jacob to the going out of his sons was about 215 years, but there were 430 years from the entrance of Abraham into Egypt. Wherefore it is said in Exodus that the dwelling of the children of Israel, which they dwelt in Egypt for 430 years, on the basis of the internal sense, represents the vast station of the church, and the state and duration of which is described by the number 430 years. So we're getting a sense of a shift here. Now we get to the correspondence of Egypt in the bad sense. The reason the firstborn of the Egyptians represented faith separated from charity is that the Egyptians were more in the knowledge of the rituals of the church than all others who constituted the representative church after the time of the flood. At that time, all rites were representative of spiritual things in heaven. The Egyptians were better acquainted with these than the rest, but in the process of time, they began to love the knowledges alone for their own sake, and to make everything of the church consist in knowledge of such things as belong to the church, and no longer in the life of charity. Thus they inverted the whole order of the church, and being inverted, the truths which are called truths of faith could not but be falsified. The kings of Egypt correspond to the scientifics in general which extinguish truths. In other words, facts that extinguish truth. This is done when the intellect enters into the things of faith in an inverted way, believing nothing but what is proven by the senses and scientific facts. So we're getting the sense that there is a truth that is independent of and can even be contrary to facts. Or I should say, facts can be used in a contrary way to divine truth. When facts serve what is spiritual, they are good. When facts as the goal or the essence of what is true begin to replace what is spiritual, then we have a problem. And here we get knowledge and reasoning from our own intelligence, which is the falsification of truth, the truth of the word. And again, after they wanted to enter by means of knowledge into the mysteries of faith, thus from their own power to investigate the truth of divine secrets, they became addicted to magic, and Egypt corresponded to scientifics which pervert, from which come falsities, and from these evils. So again, this sense of operating out of one's own knowledge or one's own ideas and to gain power is both an evil and it has an addictive attraction. And in Revelation, Sodom and Egypt correspond to all evil from the love of self and all the falsities derived from the love of self. So, we have a sense that Egypt is the realm of information, that it can be either in a good sense or in a bad or inverted sense. We're going to take this one step further. Egypt as hell. How many have been aware or thought of Egypt as hell? And we knew it was could be unpleasant. We knew it could be oppressive. But here we go. In those chapters of Genesis where it treats of the coming of the sons of Jacob and Jacob himself into Egypt to Joseph, it has treated of the initiation of the truths which are of the church into facts. And as the church is not established until this initiation is effected, therefore, according to the series of things in the internal sense, it here treats of the church established and how it is continually being infested by scientifics and falsities. For however much truths have been initiated and the church established with the person, still scientifics and falsities continually rise up and assault the things which are of the church within them. These are the things which are represented by Pharaoh and the Egyptians, afflicting the sons of Israel and wanting to murder their infant boys. They're referring here to that stage. Joseph is long since dead. The Israelites have been living in Egypt. The tables have turned. They're now enslaved by the Egyptians. And at this point, the Egyptians are attempting to murder the firstborn children to keep the population down and under control. When you're reading about this passage, this is corresponding to the scientifics and the falsities rising up and afflicting the knowledges of the church within a person. The person of the church who comes into the other life must be purified from such things as infest truths and goods. Otherwise, they cannot be elevated into heaven. On their arrival there, meaning the other world, they are therefore kept in a state in which they are assaulted by the scientifics and falsities which disagree with truths, and this until these become of no account to them and are removed. This rarely takes place with a person while they are living in the body, but in the other life it takes place with those who are to be elevated into heaven, yet with the greatest variety. These are the things which in the internal sense are described by the sons of Israel being oppressed by the Egyptians and by their afterwards being set free and after various states in the wilderness being at last introduced into the land of Canaan. Something for us to look forward to. When we enter into the spiritual world, we are going to be assaulted with all kinds of information and falsities. And the degree to which we are open and attracted to and accept and embrace these, we will be in the battle of that is called temptation. When they become so apparent as falsities or irrelevance that they cease to have any meaning for us or any influence over our inner state, then it is that we are removed from their presence. All right, one more passage. The vessels of silver and vessels of gold which belong to the Egyptians that the Israelites carried out with them, these denote scientifics of truth and scientifics of good. Silver, truth, gold, good. When yet Egyptians, both here and in what precedes, as well as in what follows, are signifying false scientifics, it is to be known that in themselves, scientifics are not truths, neither are they falsities. This being the effect of their application and use. For example, with the Egyptians there remained many things from the representatives of the ancient church, as is evident from their hieroglyphics. But as they applied them to things magical, meaning illusional, they were not true scientifics but false scientifics. Yet these same things in the ancient church were true scientifics. So all of this information that the land of Egypt represents, the facts are just neutral facts. They become true or false depending on how they are applied and used. Now, regarding the plagues that took place in the process of the Israelites extricating themselves from Egypt, these plagues are referred to as miracles. Each miracle that was done in Egypt signifies some special state into which those who come in the other life who are in falsities, which those come in the other life who are in falsities. So if you are in falsities, you're going to come in to the correspondential experience portrayed by each of the plagues. There are 10 states into which they successively come before they are entirely stripped of all truth, thus before they are cast into hell. For they who are in the knowledge of faith, but in evil of life, again, this application of what of knowledge, they're in the knowledges of faith, but in the evil of life, are not conveyed into hell immediately after death, but successively. They are first convinced that they are in evil. Afterwards, the knowledge of faith is taken away from them, and at last they are left to the evil of their own life. This is affected by a number of successive states, and these are the states which are described by the miracles or the plagues done in Egypt, and consequently by the evils which befell the Egyptians before they were immersed in the Red Sea. So this tells us again something about this process of entering into the spiritual world and what the Lord holds as of true value. You can know everything there is to know about the Bible, about doctrine, about the intricacies and the information of church, but if you don't apply those in a good life, they become the falsities which are your ticket to hell. On the contrary side of that, Jehovah brought forth the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. This corresponds to the Lord delivering from damnation those who were in the good of truth and in the truth of good. Here, the land of Egypt corresponds to damnation. Those who are in faith, separated from charity, are represented by the Egyptians, and hell is signified by the Red Sea in which the Egyptians were immersed. There's a euphemism if there ever was one. The Egyptians fled to meet it, and this means that they themselves immersed themselves in falsities from evil. The Lord protected those who were in the spiritual church from all violence from the falsities of evil. This again represented in the Lord protecting and drawing the Israelites out of Egypt. And finally, the reason that the land of Egypt corresponds to hell is that by it, in the genuine sense, is signified the natural and its scientific. And to be brought out of the natural person, the natural man, and its scientifics, and elevated into the spiritual and its intelligence and wisdom, is also to be brought out of hell. For if one does not become spiritual, they are in hell. If, again, I may refer you to this chart, we're all in our process making our way through these various states of being. As they are serving to bring us closer to heaven, they are good and true. To the degree that we remain stuck in them, or they begin to turn us or distract us away from moving closer to hell, not only are they bad, but they become hell itself. Bottom line, the ultimate criteria, if you will, if you remember the two great commandments, the love of God with everything that you are and have at your disposal, and the love of the neighbor as oneself. The inversion of these become the two great evils, the infernal loves. And the first is the love of dominion over others from the love of self. In other words, putting yourself in the place of God and ruler and most important exalted thing of the universe. And secondly, the love of reigning from the pride of our own intelligence. Being convinced that we are right, the source of truth, and having pride in what we know and using that to justify us controlling everything around us. That's the criteria that either leads us closer to heaven as we make God the center and source of life and the expression of our honoring of God, treating others with the love and kindness that we would treat ourselves. As we learn more about that and how to do it, we grow closer to heaven to the degree that we make ourselves the center of the universe and everything and everyone else subject to our own needs, the further we move away from heaven, out into the exteriors, and anything that is not heaven in the presence of God is by definition hell. All right, just a couple summary random observations. Again, it intrigues me that nobody wants to go to Egypt. It's to escape danger and death or because of some great need that can only be filled there. To speak geographically, to get to Egypt, things have to go south. I don't know if you're familiar with that phrase, but for things to go south usually means things start to go, things go bad. Thank you for cleaning that up for me. The other thing that you must realize is that to go to Egypt means to leave heaven. Going to Egypt is, they say, sojourning for a reason. It's a detour away from your goal, but is one that is necessary in order to survive or get what you need in order to get to your goal. It's like school. Who likes going to school? Yeah, there's a few weird ones out there, I know. Actually, I kind of enjoyed it myself. But it's about learning information. It's about getting what you need to prepare yourself to go do what your ultimate goal is. It's not so much about doing the thing itself. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of doing what we have to do. Maybe even what we have no interest in doing. It's about absorbing a lot of things which we then take with us when we leave. It can be good or a bad experience depending on our attitude and our purpose. Yet even at its best, it's only a temporary stay. And if you do not leave, what was at the beginning important and useful, even necessary, even life-saving, will become inverted and become a form of enslavement, perhaps addiction, which results in being stuck and the cessation of growth and movement on our journey to heaven. The attractive thing about it is that in some ways, there's a lot of busy work there. The Israelites, after they became enslaved, were certainly busy building those pyramids and the building of the Egyptians, but it really served no purpose for their goal in life. In one sense, it's safe and secure. The Israelites, even as they got out on the other side of the Red Sea, were immediately beginning complaining. Back in Egypt, we had 3 squares a day. We had a roof over our head. Slavery is definitely secure. There's no question about that. Freedom is anything but secure. It's scary. It's risky. You have nothing to depend on. But being willing to leave the security and safety and enter in, take that leap of faith into the unknown where things are not secure and sure, is what it takes to follow God. It's what it takes to leave all of these familiar places that we spend so much time in and begin the journey to get to what we hold as an ideal. Again, Egypt, even for the Lord, was a necessary stop on the journey. It's a means to an end, and all the information and useful facts about the natural level of life that we accumulate are either good or bad, depending on whether we see them as the end in and of itself and become infatuated with and even addicted to the information for its own sake, or whether all this natural information becomes the vessels and containers and the means for achieving and containing and putting to use the spiritual wisdom that comes to us from God. The floor is yours. Colgate. Sure.
The beginning of the lecture,
we'll see. That's.
I want to try to see. It really. Anyway, puts a lot of emphasis on science and natural and knowledge.
Yeah.
In the equation to get to heaven.
That's right.
And I'd like to have that expanded a little bit.
The analogy I would make is the body. Our whole focus in life is spirituality and getting to heaven and being a spiritual being. Yet as long as we're on earth, the way we do that is through living as a material being. You can't ignore your body and let it go, or you can't, I mean, you can, and you can abuse it, and you can make the experience of the body and sensual pleasures the end, the goal of your life, and in doing that, you spend and pursue what is not heavenly. But the pursuit of what is heavenly on the material plane, we do through what we experience as a physical being. So the body's incredibly important. It's the means by which we experience and develop that which makes us a spiritual person. But the goal is to be a spiritual person. We just have to get there through the means of the material. Guard.
This reminds me that our use of the word knowledge has the kind of direction toward information that is of the intellect alone. You know, it's kind of facts that the mind can, you know, receive and then store in the memory. But I think there's a way to read this where the information that in the context of which it's being spoken is a much deeper kind of knowledge than just what is of the mind alone. It would be of the body. It would be of the heart. And it would be of the mind. And specifically in the context of Egypt at that time, there's a way of reading it that it could very well be a meditation practice, which includes the discipline of quieting the mind. These were among the rituals that the Egyptians were good at.
Sure.
And the knowledges of which they are speaking are two specifically. One is the knowledge of insight, scientia cognitionum is the Latin there, and the other is the knowledge of correspondences, scientia correspondentiarum. And my feeling is that and this is germane here, they actually experienced correspondences. This was not a knowledge out of the mind. It was an actual experience of the levels of being that they became very, very skillful in. So these were attentional skills, skills of concentration, very deep concentration, which were eventually misused. So maybe to respond there, the reason this is so fundamental and Ken's way of saying it is that the body, which is the mind, the heart, and the senses, integrate to result in an experience of being a self in the world. And the cultivation of that experience in order to then begin to grow and learn is what Egypt may be about. And then finally it's the evolution of the purposes for which we do that, which start with our own survival but then go toward love of the neighbor and eventually toward a deeper universal love. I think is a way of hearing it that gives it the depth that may be explicit in that use of the word knowledge.
Yeah. Well, remember, he said the ancient church was in Egypt. And that's where, you know, I think what you're talking about them feeling correspondent, experiencing them, knowing them, not so much intellectually, but with the heart. That's what the ancient church was all about. And then the problem became when the Egyptians took, with all of that knowledge that they had, started fading back from it as a means for experiencing oneness with God, and waving the information that they knew around in order to oppress their neighbors, if I can, you know, trivialize it. But it became, they were interested in not so much spiritual experience, but in magic, creating the illusion of amazing things by manipulating information in the physical realm. And it became a truly an appearance of things. And that was the problem side of the Egyptians, which still puts the onus for what we do with the information we learn directly on us. We can take what the information that's in the realm of Egypt and apply it usefully and even sacredly to our own spiritual regeneration process, or we can just toss around the vocabulary and try to impress people with how much we know about the intricacies of theology and the doctrines of the church and not touch our spirits at all. And that's the problem side of Egypt, the negative, the inverted version of the knowledge of Egypt. That's time. All right, thank you very much.